Good morning and welcome to this month's Hancock & Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to david.lundgren@hancockbank.com and I'll take them at the end of the call. On the call today, we have Chief Investment Officer John Fortwood, Investment Directors David Lundgren, Luther McDougall, and Jeffrey Tangus. And with that, I'll pass it to David, who will be the moderator.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good morning, everyone. Welcome to another edition of our monthly economic and market update call. And John, we'll start with you, and as we normally do, start with the U.S. economy. And I guess the month of February, you know, nothing overly exciting, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but just kind of more mixed news. Anything of interest that you'd like to point out on the U.S. economy?
Well, I guess the first thing to do would be, you know, as we always do, look at the leading economic indicators and see if we see a recession or a sharp slowdown around the corner. And, you know, it still looks like a recession is not an imminent thing. As you indicated, we've had some, slowdown in demand here and there, but the leading indicators are still relatively positive. I will say, though, about the leading indicators, particularly from one particular source that I follow, fairly carefully, the total score of the leading indicator index, the composite index, is substantially lower now than it was several months ago, and it's still above, you know, a recession warning indicator level. But it does indicate that something has happened over the last several months that is relatively negative from an economic standpoint. The fourth quarter of last year was revised lower from an initial estimate of 2.6% GDP growth to 2.2%, which puts us at about a 2.35% growth rate, I guess, for all of 2014. That's pretty much in line with, you know, what we've seen and what we've been talking about now for a number of years. It doesn't seem to be really any evidence that we're about to break out of, you know, a relatively subdued trend growth in GDP. There's another interesting indicator from the Atlanta Fed. If anybody out there has the interest to do this, you can go to the Atlanta Fed and look up their GDP Now calculation, which is just their way of trying to estimate what GDP is doing, you know, from week to week and month to month. I've been following that fairly closely for the last year. It's been bouncing from, like, say 1.5 on the low side to 3.5 on the high side, depending on what kind of economic indicator is announced most recently. And it's been in that range for the better part of a year. But in the last several months, it's generally tracked at the lower end of the range, again, you know, suggesting that there has been some, you know, slowdown in the economic growth rate. If you look at spending, some of the spending numbers haven't been all that great. We had a two-month decline in personal spending recently. I think that was announced yesterday. And it's kind of odd in that that doesn't happen very often, and it's the first two-month decline that we've seen since, you know, back in 2008. 2009. Not that that by itself is significant, but again, it's just another thing indicating that we're in a relatively moderate growth rate. Core retail sales and services, excluding automobiles, year over year, tracking at last report a little under 2%. Not terrible, but in the past, and I'm talking about, you know, prior to the credit crisis and the Great Recession, that was generally associated with pre-recession conditions, but a lot of things that we've seen in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years have been in the past associated with pre-recession conditions, but that was when we had a much stronger GDP growth trend. So, you know, what we're seeing now may be more normal in light of what's happening. Spending plans by consumers, Federal Reserve Board in New York did a survey recently, and they found that if you make less than $50,000 a year, your spending plans have been declining pretty significantly since 2007 and are still falling. $50,000 to $100,000 still declining, and a fairly substantial decline in expected spending over the last several years. The only area of the economy that has seen relatively steady spending expectations in terms of this particular measure has been 100,000 or better. So it's pretty clear that, you know, there's a broad swath of the economy out there that is sort of marking time and spending very cautiously compared to what we saw in the past. So I guess the answer is, you know, moderate growth. We're getting some impact, I guess, from, you know, what's happening around the world. But, you know, overall, we're still, you know, in a positive trend, and it looks like, you know, recession is not an imminent threat.
John, I guess the other interesting economic number we saw last week was CPI. CPI year over year, I want to say it finished negative 0.1, which helped me out. I think that was the first negative year over year CPI number since maybe 2009.
Yeah, it is. In fact, it, other than the 2009 period, I think you have to go back to maybe the 1950s to see a similar number. I might be wrong about that, but you have to go back a few decades.
Now, is that just do you think that's a trend? I mean, are we kind of moving into a deflationary environment?
Some of that is probably related to oil prices.
Right.
You know, if you take oil out of that, it's probably, you know, closer to zero or maybe slightly positive. But the personal consumption expenditure number, the PCE number that the Fed likes to look at. In terms of trying to make some, you know, monetary decisions, came in at positive 0.22. So it was very close to zero itself, suggesting, well, again, there might be some more prices in there as well, I guess. But there's a deflationary trend in place around the world. You know, we talked about this before, that deflation has been, disinflation maybe is what you might say has been sort of the predominant trend in the world for a number of years, and that appears to be accelerating. Commodity prices, industrial commodity prices peaked in 2011, and of course, you know, we've had a peak in oil prices, and, you know, this is based on worldwide conditions. So it does appear that there is a deflationary bias in the world at the present time, and, you know, that may... you know, that may continue for a while.
Okay. I guess, you know, the Eurozone Greek situation, it appears that policymakers have, come to an agreement, although it seems to be rather fragile, and, you know, we continue to hear about anti-austerity measures throughout much of Southern Europe. Talk a little bit about the situation there, and have they successfully kicked the can down the road once again to where, you know, things are all calm for the time being, or are we still kind of in a tenuous situation?
It seems like we're still in a tenuous situation. You know, obviously that last decision they made collectively with Greece, the EU, kicked the can down the road, and now they're trying to find some solutions. But the things that have been coming out of Greece lately suggest that the only way they can meet the EU conditions that I guess they're discussing currently is to maybe borrow money from some of their pension funds and do this and that and the other. That just doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense. So, some kind of agreement may be arrived at, I guess, to try to keep Greece in the euro and try to calm down the situation a little bit. But it looks like it's going to be awfully difficult. I mean, Greece, societally, I guess, is dysfunctional at this point. They can't even collect taxes. But they're having runs on banks, sometimes heavy runs, sometimes just slow runs. But certainly deposits have been moving out of Greece for several years now, and that continues to occur. The country's absolutely bankrupt. So, you know, a bailout and debt forgiveness of some sort, if that does, you know, come about, and the Germans agree to sort of backstop that with a lot of their money, then in the absence of, you know, any major structural changes inside Greek society, then they probably end up becoming a permanent ward of the Eurozone and under permanent austerity. And at the same time, if you talk to the folks who examine what it would cost Greece to leave the Euro, it would be austerity all over again. It might be painful in a shorter term situation, but you know, they're kind of between a rock and a hard place, and it's kind of hard to try to figure out exactly where this is going. But the whole Eurozone is plagued with, you know, too much debt and too much welfare spending and poor productivity, and you know, they've got a monetary union that lacks the political integration and the cultural adjustments that you know are needed to make the economic environment over there function smoothly. And so, you know, it's almost an insurmountable obstacle, I guess, at this point, trying to keep the thing together. Milton Friedman, some years ago when the euro was formed, said he didn't think that union, you know, as it was being formed at the time, would survive the first financial crisis. And so here we are in a crisis that's been going on now for a number of years, and it's still there. But it seems that we might be getting closer and closer to the point where they have to make some pretty hard decisions about, you know, what they're going to do going forward, besides, you know, just using QE or some other things in an attempt to, you know, try to improve the growth outlook. But it looks like we've still got a threat of some financial disruption from Greece that, just hasn't been resolved yet.
Sounds like we'll be talking about this again next month.
Probably. I think we're all afraid that we'll be talking about it forever.
Yeah. I guess the other interesting bit of news out of the Eurozone, Germany last week, I believe it was last week, their two-year bond produced a negative yield. We're also seeing negative yields in Denmark, Finland, Switzerland. First, explain to our listeners how that works. What does it mean? And do you see this trend continuing? If there's so much, I guess the question really also is, if there's so much upheaval and concern, is this a flight to quality in specific countries? I'm trying to figure out why you have negative yields in some countries when there's, you know, concerns about defaults in others.
Those are good questions, and it's hard to really explain a lot of it in detail in the amount of time we have. But getting to what negative yields mean, that means in effect, you're buying a bond with a negative yield. You're paying so much for it that you're not getting a return at all. Either your return is zero or slightly negative. You know, in essence, you're paying someone to hold your money for a while. You're lending it, to someone for no yield at all. And it sounds odd. You wonder how a financial system can work with negative yields, and yet, you know, here, as you said, we see negative yields on bonds in a number of countries. The simple answer, I guess, is that money is looking around for a safe haven. And as the money flows into these, into these countries, into these bonds, it produces negative yields. And a lot of that has to do with what the individual, countries are doing as far as their particular, you know, monetary systems are concerned. Because what we're talking about here outside of Germany are some countries that aren't even in the euro. Denmark, for example, is not in the euro, and they're having, that kind of problem. It may be just a run into safe havens. I mean, that could be the case. Other people have speculated that there might be some money thinking that when QE really starts in earnest in Europe, since they are, so they say, a relatively small amount of bonds for the euro, for the central bank, for the European Central Bank to buy, that they'll buy so many bonds and not pay any attention to the price they pay, that if you can buy a negative yield bond now, they'll buy it and you'll still make money. I know that's bizarre, but those are the stories that are going around over there. Now, my guess is it's more of a safe haven situation than anything else. People looking for a return of their money by, you know, not necessarily return on their money and not wanting to leave it in cash. There's nowhere to, and that goes to some other costs, I guess, over there about keeping money in cash. But it's even happening on the corporate level. Two companies, Nestle and Novartis now have bonds that are selling at negative yields. So you apparently, and those are pretty strong companies, so you have some apparently some money going into those bonds. Just again, maybe it's a safe haven situation, but it's a complex situation that has to do with changes in currency values, what the different central banks are doing in Europe, and what everybody is trying to do to, you know, to keep their money safe or actually try to generate some kind of speculative return. So it's pretty messy. A lot is being written about negative yields and how negative yields might proliferate over time, considering the you know, QE and currency situations that are in play now. And if that happens, then, of course, we really will be in Wonderland and down the rabbit hole with Alice, because you wonder if that is a sustainable situation, you know, in light of the way our you know, economies generally operate. But it's not a positive sign. Let's look. I guess we can say that for sure. It's not a sign of a stable you know, relatively risk-free atmosphere when you have negative yields going on.
Makes our 0.5% on a 2-year treasury sound pretty exciting.
It does, and that's another reason, I guess, that we might continue to see good capital flows in the U.S. because, you know, the dollar is strengthening, and we've got yields that you can see, at least.
Right. Positive. Let's talk about oil for a second. You know, again, another topic we've spent many a month discussing, and, you know, the price of oil, we saw 7 consecutive months of declines. You know, we went from somewhere in the, you know, near 100 to into the 40s. And fortunately, I guess, in February, we finally, you know, saw some stability, and actually the price of oil per barrel rise slightly from, say, you know, the mid-40s to around 50. And volatility in the price of the commodity really took a step back. So do you think that we've kind of hit that point of equilibrium and some stability, and may slowly see the price of oil rise, or is this just a blip? Where are we with that?
It's we're probably not at the point of a significant rise in oil prices. One reason is that production is still pretty strong. The last reports we've had in the last few weeks suggest that production is still strong, and prices probably haven't declined down to the marginal cost of production. And you don't know exactly where that is, but that's the point where, you know, it no longer makes any sense to pump any oil, and it could be $30, it could be $20. I mean, there, you don't really know exactly, you know, where that point is, but it does appear that there is still too much production, and in a relatively slow growth, or perhaps in some areas of the world, you know, decelerating growth environment, and that's probably not a positive situation for a quick turnaround in oil prices. But I mean, at this point, people are just kind of guessing, I suppose. That you know, I would say that, you know, at best, we're not going to see much of a rise from here, with the risk that prices could move, you know, a little bit lower before we finally see the declines in production that you probably would need to see the price stabilize.
Okay. Thank you. Luther, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Excellent. Excellent also because we had an incredible February for the stock market. You know, as the year started off, we had a pretty rough January. Volatility seemed to have picked up, and then here comes February, and back to our 2014 waves where we were hitting all-time highs again. And it was pretty much across the board, whether you're looking at large-cap stocks, small-cap stocks, and even international stocks who have really struggled. Everything was up, rough numbers, about 6%. So give us a little insight on the market and why this is happening, and will it continue?
Well, I think John has touched on a lot of things that have impacted the market so far this year, particularly in February. have to remember in January the market was down 3%. A lot of that was because oil fell from 54 to down to below 46, which you referenced already. But we did get a good bounce back in February. I think there were a number of factors that are involved. John mentioned Greece, and you talked about how potentially short-term the existing arrangement is. Well, regardless of whether it's believed to be short-term or long-term in nature, the market's put it aside for right now. And we had a good rally in February based upon that. We also saw oil kind of stabilize. During February, oil went from 49 to 54 and actually ended up the month at about 50. So it didn't go down anymore or touch those lows, and we've kind of hit that $50 barrel level and stayed kind of there. I think that helped the market. The economic numbers that came in during February were also, I guess the best word is moderate. They're moderate in our eyes, but compared to the rest of the world, for the most part, it's actually pretty hot, steamy growth. We're the only ones out there where our economy is continuing to grow at a regular pace or a reasonable pace when you compare us to Europe and Asia, given a few caveats. China's still growing fairly well, but our economy's doing fairly well. And then I hate to bring it up again, but the last reason I think stocks did well in February is Tina. We've talked about this before. It's Tina. There is no alternative. You're stuck with, if you're playing in the normal arena, stocks, bonds, and cash, there are some other places you can look for some enhanced yield. But for the most part, with cash, you're looking at a yield of 0 to 0.01. Bonds, we're in an environment where potentially interest rates could start rising, and whether it's mid-year or late year or even early next year is almost irrelevant, because you'll see interest rates go up a little bit, which will impact your bond prices, meaning you're going to be lucky if you earn your coupon. So there are not a lot of options out there. So we had a good February. You mentioned that it was kind of across the board. The best performing sectors in February were consumer discretionary, which was up 8% or 8.5%. It's still one of the best performing sectors year to date. We also saw technology and materials bounce up around 8%. The one thing that really went the opposite way, we haven't touched on, and I think that was a result of the fact that interest rates actually rose during February, is utilities were up 2.37% in January. They were down 6.4% in February. So utilities are now the worst performing sector year to date, after having been a very good sector to be in for several years. But overall, the S&P is up 2.5% year to date. Small cap stocks are up 2.5%, and international is up, a little bit more than that. The strongest market has actually been the international year to date. But it was a good February. Be happy to have a month like that at any time, but there were a number of different factors out there that impacted the market. As far as going forward, we have to remember that we haven't had a correction in some time now. I don't know the date exactly, but I know we had a couple of 7 to 8% dips last year. We still haven't had that proverbial 10% correction, and we are in a market environment where valuations are, I guess, stretched, not too thin, but above normal, meaning that I think there's potential for additional move upward throughout the course of this year, but I wouldn't expect a whole lot. Last year the outlook was pretty much the same, and we ended up with a 13% return, a little higher than we expected. Maybe last year we got a little bit out of what we're going to get this year, so I'd say we're still looking for a high single-digit return for 2015.
Thank you, Luther. Jeff, I guess, one thing the market's going to be watching is the Fed. And last week, Janet Yellen testified before Congress, and based on what I read, we didn't get a whole lot more information out of that testimony other than it's kind of wait and see, and probably this year. Is that, a good way to sum up her testimony? Anything, in your opinion, change?
I think that's a good way of couching it. I mean, she continues to prepare the market for a raise, an eventual raise in short-term overnight interest rates. The big talk with the Fed, of course, is the Fed has to drop the word patient from their minutes, because she kind of painted herself into a box early on, kind of a rookie mistake when she said that as long as they mention the word patient, it means they won't raise rates for a couple meetings. So now she's got to, they've got to drop the word patient and do so without alarming the markets. They don't want the markets to think, well, it's automatic then that they start raising rates two meetings after they get rid of the word patient from their minutes. So she's been preparing the markets for that. She did that in her Humphrey Hawkins testimony, as you mentioned, by being a lot more upbeat on the labor markets. Talking about the fact that part-time workers as a proportion of everybody looking for work are dropping. So, positive things happening in the labor market. She had to comment on the international market, much like John talked about. There's certainly some issues internationally that the Fed has to keep an eye on. And so she acknowledged that but tried to downplay it by saying it doesn't really – necessarily mean that it's a serious risk to the U.S. market and to their raising rates. And so, generally speaking, she continued to to move the market in that direction. It seems to be pretty clear based on her comments and other comments by other Fed voting members after her speech that the Fed will likely drop the word patient in their March 18th meeting, so look for that. They'll probably gauge the market's response to see if the market gets too excited about that fact, but they certainly, I can't imagine anybody's going to be surprised. Stanley Fischer, who's the vice chair right behind Janet Yellen, gave a talk right after the Humphrey Hawkins and said, that it's a high probability that they will raise somewhere between June and September, that they've met their employment goal, that the Fed's not necessarily going to be mechanical in raising rates. Historically, once they start, and this is what scares everybody in the bond market, once they've started, they raise a quarter of a point at every meeting until they've reached their goal. And they've been pretty clear this time that because of the international situation, because of the lack of inflation here, that they're not likely to be as mechanical that way. But they have said that they are very concerned that investors are beginning to see zero interest rates as normal, and it's not normal. And they realize that, and so they're trying to move back to a more normal posture, which means short-term investments, overnight investments, must yield something. So stay tuned. We'll know more on March 18th when they drop the word patient. But Janet Yellen was clear in saying just because we drop the word patient doesn't mean that's automatic that we raise in two meetings. At that point, we become what she calls data dependent. And that means they'll look at each meeting, at what's on the table, and decide at each meeting. So they're preparing the market, but not necessarily, and personally I don't think it'll be in June, but they're preparing the market for that eventuality.
And, I guess, so the Fed really has greater control over shorter-term maturities or the short end of the curve. Kind of interesting what we saw with the 10-year. The 10-year dropped down to, I think, 164. At the end of January, beginning of February, which was, I think, a 14, 15-month low, and then popped quite a bit to right around 2% by the end of the month. Was that because of some of the statements made by Janet Yellen or not even related? Give us a little insight onto why we saw this big jump in interest rates in February.
Well, in February, we basically reversed course from January. January, we saw rates drop on the 10-year, using your example, from about 2.11 down to 1.64. And then in February, up until today, we reversed course and we're back up basically back to 209 exactly. So we reversed course. A lot of the decline in rates was certainly a function of what was coming out of Europe, the prospect of quantitative easing in Europe, the strength of the dollar, as John commented on, the relative attractiveness of our interest rates compared to Europe. And also we'd had some weaker economic numbers in there as well. So there was a general thinking that that the economy maybe wasn't as robust as people were thinking. And so rates dropped in anticipation of that. I think cooler heads have prevailed somewhat. People are starting to recognize the Fed will likely to start raising interest rates. But and probably the biggest reason is oil. Seemed to find something of a bottom around $50 a barrel, and once that happened, it looked like the appreciation in the dollar cooled off a little bit, and that rates started to drift back up. Basically, long-term rates are mostly influenced by inflation expectations, and I don't think inflation expectations have risen dramatically. I think it was more a fact that some of the sizzle came out of the international trade money moving in from Europe into our markets, that cooled off a little bit, and we saw interest rates pop up. But really, the only thing they did was move back up to where they were on January 1.
Okay. And where do we go from here?
Well, at this point, again, it's going to be dependent upon inflation expectations. John commented on the personal consumption expenditures number, which came in abnormally low. There was a little bit of noise in that number. There was some one-time healthcare, lower healthcare cost disinflation that was in that number. That was more of a quirk of what was something going on in Medicare. So we're likely to see, again, modest inflation numbers coming in, and I think it's possible you could see 10-year rates drifting a little higher. But certainly nothing dramatic. Short-term rates have actually moved up, while longer-term rates have mostly been stable, and that's a function of anticipation of the Fed actually moving rates up. So the curve is getting a little flatter. Most of the action seems to be in the Treasury markets in terms of those gyrations. Corporate bonds have been much more stable, as well as municipal yields. Municipal yields are largely unchanged also since the beginning of this year. So there's a lot of gyrations taking place in the Treasury markets that really aren't taking place outside in the corporate and muni area. So a lot of that is a function of the dollar and Europe and things like that. So if that, to the degree that that calms down, I think rates will stabilize.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeff, and thank you, everyone, for joining us. Please join us next month. Our call will be on Tuesday, April 7th. We'll talk to you then. Thank you.